Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
With the passing of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, obviously there's an opening on the Supreme Court. The question is, when should that be filled? And obviously the Republicans over the past several days have been working the corridors of their members in the hopes of trying to do so before the election. Joining us to talk about this and the other issues in and around this election process is Trevor Burrus, research fellow at Cato's Robert A. Levy Center for Constitutional Studies and editor-in-chief of the Supreme Court Review. Trevor, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Trevor, it didn't take long for this to become contentious. I'd say all of about 5 seconds. I was at dinner Friday night. I've got the news notice on my phone, and immediately after that, probably 5 seconds later, started to get comments being made by both sides of the aisle. I don't know if your experience was the same.
Oh, yeah, and of course, the first thing is this question of what the Republicans did with Merrick Garland. And so that's the first thing they can call out. And hypocrisy will, I guess, only get you so much traction in the political debate, especially if it's not going to dissuade many supporters. But this has been going on for, of course, about, 15 years at a fever pitch, but even longer. So many times when some side does something, the other side will do it back to them. And so we just played this sort of horrible political battle. We eliminate the filibuster. And of course, they borked Robert Bork in the 80s. And now we're here. It probably will be the most contentious nomination process in our history. Might even make Kavanaugh look like a minor league game.
Is that possible?
I think with the possibility of mass protests, if not occupation of Capitol building, I think that they're underplaying how much that actually might happen in the situation. I mean, since it's likely, it's going to be a woman, I think that's a pretty sure bet. And if it's someone like Amy Coney Barrett, then one of the reasons they decide to choose her is because she's hard to impeach along the lines of what Kavanaugh does. Of course, she's a woman. She's devoutly Catholic. She's got 7 kids. So it's very hard to impeach her that way, but they'll figure out whatever they can. That's the way things work now. And I'm not just accusing Democrats of this. Republicans will do the same thing going forward, too.
No, I mean, that's why I don't even get caught up in the hypocrisy argument. I mean, it is what it is. And I mean, we could find clips from both sides of the aisle to say otherwise. I made the observation yesterday, and I was watching a number of the news shows last evening, from both CNN, MSNBC, and Fox and others. And it seems to me, in different perspectives, it all comes back to Roe v. Wade. And it just seems that has been, that one singular issue has been the most divisive issue as it relates to this court. Your thoughts?
I think that is true. I think that Roe v. Wade is the galvanizing force for the conservative legal movement. I think that it became galvanizing for splitting these two sides. And it shows the way you don't sort of decide these kind of issues in a diverse, huge country like the United States. There are many things to critique about Roe v. Wade, and I myself as a libertarian go back and forth on abortion. But the question of whether or not there should be a one-size-fits-all rule for the entire nation that then will divide us. I mean, before Roe v. Wade, it wasn't clear that evangelicals were on the Republican side of the partisan divide. And after Roe v. Wade, it became very clear that that was the case. I do think, though, that there are issues, gun rights being another one, size of government, scope of congressional powers that also divide things. But I don't disagree. Roe v. Wade is the sort of starting point of this. And I do wish that people would have a better sense of what would happen if Roe v. Wade were overturned. I don't actually think that's much of a danger. And I think that Chief Justice John Roberts would do everything to try and not have his court overturn Roe v. Wade because of the sort of crisis that would come from that. But if Roe v. Wade had never been decided, people always talk about like abortion would be illegal in this country. What that would mean is that every state would decide its own laws about abortion, and you could have a discussion about them. You could take all of the power that pro-choice and pro-life groups do to try and influence our nomination process, and they would be going to state legislators and trying to influence the laws surrounding around abortion in a given state, both sides being essentially lobbying groups. And you would have probably abortion fully illegal in maybe 8 states in the South and different degrees of legal in about 42 states. That would the world would look like, would be my prediction. But we don't have that ability anymore because the Supreme Court sort of took that ball and took it out of the political arena. And so now we politicize the court.
There are those that are saying that obviously this nomination process is going to take all of the oxygen out of the room. We're looking for congressional aid to state and local government, congressional aid to individuals in light of the pandemic. And I wonder if that same thing can't be said, as you just outlined, that there are so many peripheral issues to Roe v. Wade, one major one being states' rights, that Roe has actually taken the oxygen out of the legal room.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And we can't, there's always been this debate about, well not always, the originalism versus sort of living constitution debate. It sort of postdates Roe's decision in 1973. Originalism partially comes out of trying to go against the Warren Court and Roe v. Wade and articulate a judicial philosophy that would at least in theory not just have a judge voting their preferences. You didn't see a lot of this beforehand. So we have had a change in terms of how the debate has evolved. But in terms of the backdrop of Roe being taking all the sort of debate about how we interpret our Constitution, because right now, for example, this is as someone who is an originalist, I would very much have appreciated if the left, and this happened a little bit, but not enough, if the left joined us in what we've been doing at Cato since our founding and sort of ringing the bell about too much executive power, right? So that's been a problem for a very long time, and mostly conservatives, but definitely libertarians have been the ones who've been saying, this is a problem, and it shouldn't be a problem when you elect the guy who has the power. It will be, we have to come up with principles. And so we get Donald Trump in office who, like most presidents, especially recently, kind of moves the baseline up of what is now presidential power. So now we have the national emergency executive order question, which unfortunately, there's an argument that Congress gave that power to the president, including, say, the steel tariffs, where he can, at his discretion, adjust tariffs in the interest of national security. Same with TikTok, what's happening there. That's just too much power with one man. So as opposed to, if we're doing is talking about Roe, which, of course, in this nomination process, the candidate, especially if it's Amy Coney Barrett, will be asked about it incessantly. I wish some people, especially on the left, would say, hey, what do you think about executive power? Do you think maybe we should roll that back some? But no, we'll be talking about Roe most of the time.
Yeah, and part of the problem, though, is that the utilization of executive power has really come about because of the inability to create a culture of compromise within Congress, has it not?
Absolutely. It's a combination of those two things. A culture of compromise. I think the one thing that the framers would never have predicted is that Congress wouldn't jealously guard its power, that it wouldn't try to keep its power to legislate in the congressional and Senate, in the two houses. Instead, for decades now, since the 30s in particular, members of Congress and senators have willingly given away their power to the executive for the purpose of scoring political points, meaning that when they empower agencies to legislate, essentially, they can either take credit or not take credit as politically convenient for them, and they never have to really take a consequential vote. That has produced a lot more demagoguery. We also, of course, have an underlying political partisan divide that is based in urban versus rural. It's not actually red state versus blue state, really. It's urban versus rural. And so members of Congress who come from rural districts are going to be a little bit more extreme than members of Congress who come from urban districts, so they can't make good compromises anymore. We live in a world where most legislating is done during periods where one party controls both houses in the presidency, which is only usually for a two-year period. So in the wake of all that, the president is the only one who can often do things. And that's just very unfortunate to have a non-functioning Congress and a president, whoever it is, who actually has more powers than King George III that we fought a war to get rid of.
Yeah. One of the things that has mystified me with, you know, early onset with this obvious the nomination process is that we have Democratic leaders. In fact, Chuck Schumer the other day said that we need to maintain and foster the legacy of RBG, and that this is a threat to democracy if we don't do that. That statement absolutely completely mystifies me within the confines of a constitutional republic. I don't know what he's talking about. Do you?
No, generally when I hear someone like Chuck Schumer say the word democracy, I have to run it through a translator in my brain and see what he actually means about it, because that word, especially by the left, is used to mean a lot of things that most people wouldn't say democracy about. I think what he would be saying is something about the legacy of Ruth Bader Ginsburg and, say, voting campaigns and campaign finance decisions and stuff like that as a threat to democracy. But that, you know, this... We don't guarantee a seat for an ideological commitment. I mean, as much as I think that I want the Republicans to be thinking long term, I just want everyone to be honest. It's been, you know, such a trying year in so many ways, and so many things in our country look precarious. And one of the things that's causing that is that we have very few politicians on either side looking for the long term health of the country rather than the short term political gains that they can make. And of course, while the Republicans in the Senate and the president have the absolute constitutional right to do what they want, the Constitution itself doesn't explain all the ways that you should behave. It's only 4,500 words. It doesn't give all the rules for running a liberal, in the small L sense, constitutional republic. And so, you know, right now the rule is that, yes, the president can do this and they can confirm, and it has been done before. But if the court packing is going to happen, I think that Republicans and Democrats, maybe just some of the adults in the room, need to get together. Say if the Democrats sweep everything in the election, get together and come up with some rules that they both can agree on, so we don't have to have these fights anymore in the way that we've been having them. And so, I mean, Chuck Schumer is articulating a bunch of things there. But, you know, the court swings back and forth. That's what it always has done in history. But now it just seems a little bit more rancorous and difficult than ever before.
Is that, to me, you know, as a lawyer, although I've never really practiced constitutional law, but when I look at it, it seems to me that the court has become the moral barometer, the moral compass for the country. And I'm not sure that that's the role of the judicial branch.
Yes, absolutely not. I just wish the Supreme Court mattered a lot less than it does. There's a few reasons why it matters too much. It depends on what you're talking about. From my standpoint, for example, the powers of Congress are far too broad. So the court should never have been put in a situation where, in the Obamacare case in 2012, that they were possibly deciding a case where they're taking away people's health care, because the Constitution gives Congress no power over health care. And you have to do a very strained reading to get to that point, which, of course, they did. So that just puts the court in fights that it really shouldn't be involved in. Now, when it comes to the Bill of Rights, those are fights that they more often need to be involved in some way. But yes, at the same time, we shouldn't be having existential threats because one justice died. That's not a tenable position for a constitutional republic.
So obviously, it looks as though with Mitt Romney coming on board this morning, he was a wild card. It looks like the Republicans are kind of lining up their group. Last evening, a number of whom actually said they have the votes. I think Lindsey Graham made that statement, as well as Ted Cruz from Texas made that statement. Is that kind of your feel as you see this lining up?
Yeah, I see 51 right now, unless there's some pressure that's put on. Now, the question what the Democrats will be doing, they raised a ton of money from all reports, just from even the night that Justice Ginsburg died to today, on this question of fighting this political fight. So they'll probably put a bunch of that money into trying to sway maybe some of the Democrats, Susan Collins and Murkowski in particular, sway their election. I'm actually not sure if they're who's up for re-election, but sway the people there to write to them and try and make sure that they can't, you know, they might be able to do this. But assuming that doesn't happen, which I think is probably the best assumption, we'll probably see this confirmation go through. It'll be interesting if it happens in the lame duck session or not. That's another thing that I predict the Democrats will try to do, which is to delay, and that might include a tactic similar to what they employed with Kavanaugh. Again, if it's Amy Coney Barrett, I very much doubt she has skeletons in her closet. They will go after her religion, of course, as they did in her confirmation for the Seventh Circuit. But as Feinstein did with Kavanaugh, bringing out these allegations near the end of the confirmation process is something that they will also be talking about to get it after the election day. But it's not going to be fun. It'll be a pretty shameful and embarrassing few weeks in American politics, I predict.
When we talk about religion, as a number of nominees have had to face that question, I mean, has it got to the point that we're not free to exercise our faith, and we can't be independent, and we can't be true to the Constitution because we're of one belief or another? We have to be completely agnostic?
I think it goes back to Roe. I don't think that we would have had. Take a given Catholic or Protestant that committed nominee. How does a Protestant rule about, First Amendment issues there's nothing in the Protestant religion about these Fourth Amendment issues or anything.
Right.
But if it's abortion, that's where they're going to bring up the religion aspect. And it is very unfortunate. I don't think that we're getting to the point that, judges can't use their consciences, and vote their consciences. But it will be disturbing to see how much they go after, assuming it is Amy Coney Barrett, her religion. And it probably won't ultimately play well for Democrats who, despite, some of them living in enclaves where they probably have never met a Christian, still a huge amount of Americans in this country are professed Christians. So it might actually end up disgusting those voters more than winning anyone over.
Yeah, I hadn't looked at it in a while, but I wonder what the underlying data actually shows as it relates to abortion in this country. How many are actually performed, and how many by private practice as opposed to otherwise in publicly funded clinics or otherwise? And I'm just kind of curious as to what the numbers actually are. Sometimes you wonder whether or not we're fighting on something that is actually de minimis in nature.
Well, the public opinion shifts in different ways on abortion. And if I remember correctly, since Roe, the amount of people who are pro-life has increased. Now, in terms of numbers of abortion, there are some numbers on those. There are no publicly funded abortions due to the Hyde Amendment, which goes back indirectly.
Well, since. Yeah, I stand corrected. I realized what I said.
But it's hard to say. I don't know. But I think, again, abortion is one of these issues where the extreme on each side are kind of pushing each other to take more extreme positions. And a lot of people in the middle regard it as a fundamentally difficult question, whereas each side seems to not regard it as a fundamentally difficult question. But they drive the debate. And it kind of, I think, confuses a lot of people who sort of sit there and say, I can see arguments from both sides, and I'm not so sure, where people are yelling in each ear, telling them that there's only one way to look at this question, which is, again, why it's difficult for a judge or a justice to decide whether or not this contentious and fundamentally morally difficult question is in the Constitution in some way.
Yeah. What, as Pelosi says, what arrows in the quiver do they have in actually to delay this so that it does not happen before the election? I mean, obviously, the majority gets to set the agenda, the timing, and everything else. What could they possibly do to delay it?
Not many. The thing that I think is most concerning is actual physical action, riots or some sort of protest where they try to actually delay it. I expect, say, if you are going to if we saw during Kavanaugh, we saw the amount of disruptions during his hearings, and now, of course, we have the pandemic, so there will be different rules about whether or not these things are even public, which it probably won't be, or in some way limited, but they will try to disrupt, just I would say, in many physical ways, everything that's going on, which will play, it could play poorly for them again in the question for the election. In terms of what the House has no ability to do anything. And again, like I mentioned before, the question of how much they can just play politics on a state level, spend this money on ads. You'll expect to see an amazing amount of ads about this just in the next week or so that just come up and talk about this. And then any sort of dirt they can find. So they definitely already have employed everyone to look as much as they possibly can at anything that could give pause to anyone about this. And I think that's pretty much the only arrows that are in their quiver.
Trevor Burrus, we're talking to research fellow at Cato Institute. He is the editor-in-chief of the Supreme Court Review. Do you have a few more minutes? We got to get to a break.
Yeah.
I'd love to talk to you about packing the court. And
yeah,
I know
absolutely.
It's been tried before. A lot of folks don't necessarily understand that tactic, and I'd like to talk about that a little. We'll be right back after the break. 504-260-1870 on the mortgage, financial phone, and text line. Stay with us, folks. We'll be right back. We're back with Trevor Burrus, research fellow at Cato's Robert A. Levy Center for Constitutional Studies and editor-in-chief of the Cato Supreme Court Review. Trevor, in the aftermath of Ruth Bader Ginsburg's passing, obviously a number of Democrats talked about the arrow in the quill, and they said that one was making D.C. a state, making Puerto Rico a state, thereby picking up four Senate votes they think that Democrats would be elected in there, and that's probably a good bet, maybe a better bet than the Secretariat. But also they talked about packing the court. And a lot of people, I don't think, realize that the number of justices on the court is actually decided by the Congress, right?
Mm-hmm. It's been set at 9 here since 1869, actually, the Judiciary Act of 1869. Before that, it had gone back and forth. It's been as low as 5 and as high as 10. But since 1869, it's been 9. Now, the most famous example of court packing, it has occurred under very – at different times when they've changed the amount of justices, and they have been very, very obviously political circumstances. For example, in 1801, if we know about Adams versus Jefferson, Adams signed a law that reduced the amount of the court to 5 from 6 to try and stop judicial appointments for Thomas Jefferson. So it's been that way for a while, but we've kind of came to an agreement on 9 up until Franklin Roosevelt's famous attempt to pack the court in 1937, which went famously poorly for him. And this was at a time when he had won massive re-election in 1936. He thought he could do anything he wanted with a full House and a Democrat House and a Democrat Senate. But even then, his party came to him and said, no, this is not okay. His vice president opposed him. The public never got above 50%. And he was obviously doing this because the Supreme Court had ruled against some of his New Deal programs and struck them down, especially the four conservative justices, the four horsemen, and sometimes the chief justice or a couple other justices joining in. And Roosevelt at the time was blatantly lying when he said that I'm doing this because the court has too many old people on it and they can't get their work done. So I'm going to be able to appoint a new justice for every justice over 70 up to six justices. And of course, the court was getting all of its work done. It was blatantly transparent. So for a very long time, court packing has been a third rail in American politics. And since the court has become more sort of mired in controversy, the Democrats have been discussing it in different ways. And actually, a Democrat friend of mine said to me explicitly, a pretty powerful guy who works in the circles, he said explicitly that they will, if Trump gets to replace Ginsburg, they will pack the court. Now, he's not a sitting politician or anything, but that sort of displays the way they're thinking. And that would be, I think, a catastrophe. It would politicize the court even more than it possibly can be. And we would just see this court, whose entire legitimacy, if you think about this, I mean, Hamilton writes about this in Federal 78. The court has neither sword nor purse. It can't enforce its own rulings. Its entire legitimacy is that the public, the other branches of government, and state and local governments see the court as legitimate. So when they rule on a case, they say, well, the court has spoken. If we get to this point that, you know, the Democrats add three justices and then the Republicans next time they have to take three away, and we have this sort of ping pong effect going back and forth, which, you know, it would be absolutely devastating to the court and its perception, which has actually been doing pretty well in the last few years. Of the court, even from the left, has gotten better because the court has kind of gone back and forth on a bunch of different rulings in unpredictable ways. But I guarantee that this is John Roberts' worst nightmare. He's already tried very hard to keep his court from being overly political and from getting involved in too many cases. For example, not taking gun cases, I think partially because he doesn't want to have that kind of stuff on the court's docket unless it absolutely is necessary. This is everything he's been fighting against, and it would be a huge mistake.
Ironically, RBG was against it as well. Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Every justice would be against it.
In an interview 2 years ago, I believe, said that, you know, nine seems to be a number that has worked very well, and thought that court packing and even the discussion about court packing is not a good thing for the court.
Oh, yeah, well, the story goes, I mean, there's a little bit things wrong with it, but the story goes that even the discussion of court packing in 1937 influenced at least one justice, Justice Owen Roberts, to change his vote because it was so nakedly political, and would have been so damaging to the court that the story goes that Owen Roberts said, okay, well, I'll vote for some of your New Deal programs. It's not that simple, but that's how kind of even a discussion of court packing can be a sword of Damocles that hangs over the court in a way that, you know, one of the things that works very well in our system, you know, we look at our system of government, these constitutional guardrails that have been set up. And there's ones that we take for granted, and there's ones that have been violated, and now they don't even really matter anymore. But independent judiciary is one of the hardest things to set up in any other country that's trying to set up a constitutional republic, because the judiciary cannot be seen as being sort of handmaidens to the political branches. So under our Constitution, you cannot fire a judge or a justice without impeaching them, and you can't raise or lower their pay either. So after Trump, you know, nominated and the Senate confirmed Gorsuch and Kavanaugh, they are free from any control that he could have, right? They don't have to worry about that stuff. You add in them justices worrying about what would happen if they make one party mad. Well, they pack the court when they make a decision, and you really compromise the independent judiciary, which is one of the things that works really well in our constitutional republic. That is exactly why Justice Ginsburg was against court packing, and I guarantee every justice and judge in this country is against court packing.
This is going to be a very political question. If you don't want to answer, please don't. Just tell me. But how long before the Democrats actually turn on Ruth Bader Ginsburg for not stepping down during the Obama years? In fact, the over and under, it, in my view, it's not going to be very long before they blame her for being in this predicament.
It depends on what you mean turn on. I don't think in the sense that word is usually, the phrase usually used, they would turn on her. There have been complaints about this for quite a while, right? I mean, when she was still, you know, in her 80s, when she had a chance with Obama and a Democrat Senate to kind of make this easier. And, you know, but then she's had, of course, she had immense health problems, and her strength and her physical fitness regimen and stuff is what helped her live as long as she did. But yes, they will be upset about it. You will now see this sort of unfortunate aspect of the way we nominate justices going forward. The first question is they'll be so divided that you have to retire when the president of your party, quote unquote party, is in power. And there will be immense pressure from both sides on that, which is unfortunate because we shouldn't really look at these jurists as Democrats or Republicans as much as the American public wants to do that. If you actually follow the court like I do, their votes are extremely unpredictable. Like I always point out, for example, that in the Obamacare case, when they struck down the Medicaid expansion part of that, which is an often forgotten part of that, that was a 7-2 vote, including Kagan on that vote and Breyer. So these are not political actors in the way that we believe them to be. But as you said, now we're going to have a new normal, and we could get to the new normal, and this would be a huge institutional breakdown of the norms that will actually run our constitutional republic, where the rule is just no opposing Senate will ever confirm any opposite party president's nominee. That's sort of as far down the slope as you could go. And right. And that just becomes extremely unfortunate in just how we comport ourselves as a nation and just having any sense of virtue. As I said, there are things that you can do. There are many things you can do under the Constitution. There are just things that you shouldn't or you don't. And so many of those have gone out the window from both sides. And, of course, Trump is breaking them all the time. And it's just unfortunate where someone needs to stand up. And I don't know who it would be. We could resurrect. This morning I reread George Washington's farewell address, which I highly commend to everyone, if they haven't read it, to go back and read Washington's warnings about what would happen to our country. And there are two main ones. One is about foreign policy. That one's about partisan. Partisan politics could consume the country. And he saw that in 1796. And it's getting that way today.
Yeah. I actually, Ruth, Justice Ginsburg's stock went up in my eyes when she kind of rejected that notion of, leaving the court for the purposes of President Obama then to have another appointment. I think it would have destroyed her legacy, quite frankly, being a very independent-minded woman, fighting for gender rights all those years, very strategic in the way that she did things. And I just think to ask someone to do that when they otherwise can fulfill the duties of the office, I think is really condescending and short-term thinking at its best.
Exactly. And the justices, all of them, there's great mutual respect between the justices. As I said, they do not view themselves or others. It's nakedly political actors, I'm quite sure. They are having an intellectual conversation. And everything, the other thing about Justice Ginsburg is her deep friendship with Justice Scalia. You asked about, how quick is it to people on the left might cancel Ginsburg for not stepping down. But the question is, because she befriended Justice Scalia, would they cancel her for that? As opposed to using that friendship as a model of the kind of understanding and liberal, small L attitudes that need to exist between people who understand that, part of this, the entire liberal project in the small L sense is about respecting people's differing opinions, giving them the right to rule, and even when you lose, is all these things that become much more difficult when each side views the other side as an existential threat. And the Ginsburg-Scalia, the friendship, which has been written about extensively, is just an example of what you can do, even when you are deeply, deeply committed, people with ideologies and philosophies.
My wife's a lawyer. I'm a lawyer. We agree to disagree all the time. Trevor Burrus, thank you so much for joining us today. Really, really enjoyed the conversation. We'd love to have you back on.
Anytime. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. We'll be right back after the break. 504-260-1870. Stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.